Chapter 15.
I could get used to this, Sam said, staring into the fire.
I'll second that, Remy replied.
They'd decided to accept their host's invitation to spend the night at the hut. As the sun dipped toward the horizon, Sam strolled the beach and gathered burnable driftwood, while Remy used their host's collapsible bamboo fishing rod to snag a trio of snapper from the surf. By the time night fell, they were lying against a log before a crackling campfire, their stomachs full of braised and sea-salted fish. The night was clear and black, with diamond-speck stars filling the sky. Aside from the swoosh hiss of the surf and the occasional rustling of palm fronds, all was quiet. Their host hadn't been joking about the wine cellar, which, though barely larger than a closet, sported 24 bottles. They'd chosen a Jordan Chardonnay to complement Remy's catch. They sat and sipped and watched the stars until finally Remy said,
"You think they'll find us?"
"Who? Arkhipov and Kolkov? Not likely." For the airline tickets, the hotel, and the rental car, they'd used a credit card attached to a twice-removed Fargo Foundation expense account. While Sam had no doubt Bondurek's hatchet men had the resources to eventually unravel the financial trail, it wouldn't happen, he hoped, before they were gone. "Unless," he added, "they already have a lead that points them here."
"There's a cheery notion." "Sam, I've been thinking about Ted. That Russian, Arkhipov. He was going to kill him, wasn't he?"
"I suspect so."
"Over wine. What kind of man would do that?
If Rube's right, Bondurek's filthy rich. What he'd gain from selling the lost cellar would be pocket change. Why is he willing to kill for it?"
"Remy, for him murder comes naturally. It's not a last resort, it's a ready option."
"I suppose.
But you're not convinced."
"It just doesn't add up.
Is Bondurek a wine collector? A Napoleonophile, maybe?"
"I don't know. We'll check."
She shook her head, frustrated. After a few moments of silence, she asked,
"So where do we start?"
"We have to make some assumptions," Sam replied. "First, that Selma's right about the goat's head being a landmark. And second, that Boehm and his team would have chosen the most uninhabited part of the island to set up shop. This coastline certainly fits the bill. At first light, we pile our gear into the dinghy."
"Not the plane?"
"Don't think so. Boehm's vantage point would have been from the surface. From the air, a goat's head could look like a duck's foot or a donkey's ear or nothing at all."
"Good point.
Erosion's going to be a problem. 60 years of weather could change a lot."
"True."
The Bahamian archipelago was a spelunking and cave-diving paradise, Sam knew, and there were 4 general types of cave systems. Blue holes, which came in both the open ocean and inshore variety, and were essentially great tubes plunging hundreds of feet into the ocean or an island's rock strata. Fracture-guided caves, which followed the natural fissures in the bedrock. Solutional caves, which formed over time by rainwater mixing with minerals in the soil to dissolve the underlying limestone or calcium carbonate bedrock. And finally, garden-variety sea caves, formed along cliffs by thousands of years of pounding surf. While these systems rarely went any deeper than 100 feet, they were also usually spacious and offered sheltered underwater entrances. Precisely what one might look for when scouting for a spot to hide a mini-submarine.
"You missed one," Remy said.
"An assumption, I mean."
"Which is?"
"That all this isn't just a goose chase. Or, to be exact, a wild moch hunt."
They woke at dawn, had a breakfast of wild grape, fig, and pigeon plums, all of which they found growing wild within 100 yards of the hut, then piled their gear into the inflatable dinghy and set out. The trolling motor wasn't going to help them set any speed records, but it was fuel-efficient and powerful enough to get through the reef line and to navigate the inshore tides. By the time the sun had lifted free of the horizon, they were tooling north along the coast, parallel to the reef line.
The water was a crystalline turquoise, so clear they could see rainbow-hued fish skimming along the white sand bottom 20 feet below. As Sam steered, staying as close to the shore as possible, which ranged from 50 to 100 yards, Remy sat in the bow, alternately scanning the cliffs through her binoculars and taking shots with her digital SLR camera. Occasionally, she would call for Sam to come about and make a repeat pass of a rock formation as she tilted her head and squinted her eyes and took more pictures before eventually shaking her head and giving him the okay to proceed. The hours and the coastline slipped by until around noon they found themselves nearing the island's headland and Junkanoo Rock. Beyond that, on the northern shoreline, lay Port Boyd and the island's more populous western areas. Sam turned the dinghy around, and they headed south. "We've probably already passed dozens of sea caves," Remy said. This was true. Many of the cliff faces they'd surveyed were shrouded in climbing vines and scrub foliage that jutted from every nook and cranny. From this distance, they could be seeing a cave entrance and never know it. They had little choice, however. Slipping inside each reef break and checking every foot of every cliff would take years. More frustrating still was that most of their search had so far occurred during low tide, which should have given them the best chance to spot an opening. Suddenly, Remy sat up straighter and cocked her head, a posture Sam knew only too well. His wife had had a eureka moment. "What?" he asked. "I think we're going about this the wrong way. We're assuming Boehm used this goat's head as a navigation aid while test-driving the Molch before the mission, correct? They'd want to test out any refit work they'd done, wouldn't they?" "I'd hope so. And close to shore, they wouldn't have risked grounding the sub by diving, which meant the Molch probably didn't roam too far. The Molch's mothership, the Lotrinen, would have been equipped with an advanced open-ocean navigation system, but not so the mini-submarine, which would have relied on speed distance, dead reckoning, and, quite likely, visual aids." "Right again. So what if the only time Boehm would have to rely on a landmark was when he was coming back in from a test dive?" "From offshore," Sam finished. "Inshore, a goat's head might not look like a goat's head, but from a mile or two out to sea..." Remy was smiling and nodding. Sam brought the dinghy about and pointed the nose toward open ocean. Once they were a mile out, they repeated their tour of the coastline, heading back the way they'd come, past their landing beach toward the southeastern tip of the island, Signal Point, and Port Nelson, where they turned around and headed north again. By 3:30, tired, thirsty, and slightly sunburned despite their hats and repeated coatings of bullfrog sunscreen, they were a mile from the northern headland when Remy, who was studying the coast through her binoculars, held up a closed fist. Sam throttled down to an idle and waited. Remy turned in her seat and leaned back to hand Sam the binoculars. "Take a look at that cliff," she pointed, "bearing about 280 relative. Sam aimed the binoculars and panned along the rock face. "See the two banyan trees sitting next to one another?" Remy said. "Hold on." "Okay, I see them." "Imagine them 60 years ago, about a third their size, with less branches. Add a little dimension to the rock." Sam made the elusive adjustment and looked again, but after 10 seconds shook his head. "Sorry." "Squint," Remy offered. He did, and suddenly, as if someone had flipped a switch, he saw it. 6 decades of erosion had, in fact, softened the bump in the cliff, but there was no doubt. Combined, the outcropping and the twin banyans formed the vague profile of a goat's face topped by a pair of overgrown and tangled horns. The question was, were they seeing what they wanted to see, the victims of self-suggestion, or was there really something there? One look at Remy's face told him she was wondering the same thing. "One way to find out," he said. The break in the reef was narrow, less than 8 feet wide, and with high tide and churn, the top of the coral was submerged just enough to be invisible at a distance, but close enough to the surface to rip the dinghy's rubber skin to shreds should Sam stray. Remy sat in the bow, arms braced on the side walls as she leaned forward and peered into the water. "Left! Left! Left!" she called. "Okay, straighten out. Steady on." On either side of the dinghy, through the froth, Sam could see dagger-edged coral just beneath the turquoise surface. He jinked the throttle and rudder, searching for that delicate balance between steerageway and power. Not enough of the former, and he couldn't avoid being pushed onto the coral. Too much of the latter, and he couldn't respond to Remy's signals. "Good. Hard right." Sam pushed the rudder over and the dinghy veered just as a wave broke on the reef and knocked the stern around. "Hold on." He powered up and compensated. "Left. A little more. More. How far to go?" 10 more feet and we're through." Sam looked over his shoulder. A swell was rising 20 feet behind them, building up on the reef's outer edge. "Gonna get hit," Sam called. "Brace yourself." "Almost there. Veer right. Straight now. Good. Give it all you've got." Sam cranked the throttle to its stops just as the wave broke under the dinghy's stern. Sam felt his belly lurch into his throat. For a brief second, the prop lifted free of the water with a sputtering whine, then the dinghy was slapped back onto a calm lagoon. Remy rolled onto her back, leaned against the bow, and let out a sigh. "I'll say it again, Sam Fargo. You sure know how to show a girl a good time." "I do what I can. Welcome to Goat's Head Lagoon."